Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of You Make Me Sick. Before we start the show, just want to make an announcement that moving forward, we'll have a new host on the show. She is a colleague of mine, Michaela Wynn. Michaela is a registered nurse at Boston Medical Center. She works in the medical ICU. She has been an ICU nurse for over 8 years now. She holds her bachelor's in nursing as well as a master's in nursing from Walden University. She is as enthusiastic as I am about pretty much all things medically related, infectious disease, medical technologies, all that fun stuff that we talk about on the show. So she is here today on her maiden voyage, the You Make Me Sick podcast, and she's going to be interviewing Dr. Chris Kearney, a pulmonologist, as they speak about prior authorization, which is a convoluted and frustrating process which is used to determine who is granted access to certain medications, medical treatments, and often life-saving interventions. So everybody, like to just welcome Michaela as she interviews Dr. Kearney.
Well, hello, I'm Michaela Wynn. I'm here, a registered nurse at Boston Medical Center. I'm joined today by Dr. Kearney, who serves as a board-certified pulmonologist in critical care attending here in the medical ICU. And we are going to be talking about prior authorizations today. Thank you, Chris, for joining us.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So let's just start with the basics. So before certain medications or treatments can be prescribed, insurance providers often require approval through a process called prior authorization. And this can be a difficult and frustrating experience for both the patients and the providers. So can you explain what prior authorization is and how the process typically works?
Sure. So it's usually applied to more expensive medications, which are less commonly utilized and create a burden for insurers. And so to try and ensure appropriate use, they require you to solicit approval before prescribing. And if the medication is filled beforehand, the patient would be expected to pay full price and not have coverage from their insurance program. So the way it goes about is we would prescribe medication, understand that it requires a prior authorization, and then luckily here in our clinic, we have a pharmacy team that helps with that process. So we'll reach out to the pharmacy team and say, here's the diagnosis we're treating, here's the medication we require, and the dosage. They'll fill out a standardized form and submit that process. Hopefully it gets approved. Mm-hmm. If it gets declined, then there's sort of escalating stages. You can request a peer-to-peer, so you'll ask to speak with a physician from the insurance program to discuss why, in this case, you want that specific medication or imaging procedure or a procedure to be performed. And then, hopefully, that finishes the process. If that does not come to an agreement, then the next stage is an appeal, and then following that, there's an external appeal. So there's sort of tiers you have to go through to try and get the medication or other process that you want done.
Wow. Yeah, so they were originally designed to ensure high-quality, evidence-based, and cost-effective treatment. So in your experience, do you think those remain the guiding principles, or have the priorities of insurance companies shifted over time?
I think it's difficult to ascribe intent, and so I will try and be diplomatic and not say things I don't know.
Yep.
I will say I harbor deep skepticism that the motivations are pure. I think one important piece of information, you know, United Healthcare has the highest or among the highest denial rates and has $400-500 billion revenue and made $15-20 billion in profit. And I fear and worry that this process is being used to maximize profits and is not as much of a tool to try and provide an equitable distribution of resources for our patients.
So one of the original intentions behind the prior authorization was to control prescription drug costs. And this was by promoting the use of generics over brand name medications. As of 2024, roughly 50% of drugs covered under Medicare Part D require prior authorization. So in your view, is cost reduction still a genuine goal, or are insurers primarily trying to cut their own expenses?
I think I'll share that my skepticism is high that profit is a driver for this. However, I think I need to at the same time recognize that there's a tension. So I, at the bedside, am thinking purely about the patient in front of me.
Yeah.
How can I take the best care? Cost does not come into that decision making.
Right.
And if we had a healthcare system where each individual practitioner was doing the exact same, we unfortunately do live in a resource-limited society. You know, healthcare is, what, 17, 18% of GDP. Healthcare expenditures are climbing. Government budgets are straining. And so I recognize that there needs to be some mechanism to try and constrain spending, some mechanism to try to find a degree of control over costs that is not the primary motivation of the clinician at the bedside.
Yeah.
And so I recognize that prior authorizations or other utilization restriction protocols perhaps are necessary in a resource-limited climate, but my interaction with them is certainly unpleasant and I think limits my ability to care for the patients in front of me.
Yeah. So I think having you at the bedside as a physician, you are definitely seeing firsthand the impacts on patient care and delays. And these delays can lead to worse health outcomes and even increase the risk of mortality. You're saying that you agree that the prior authorization process will impact a patient's ability to receive timely care?
I think it's well documented that prior authorizations are associated with delays in care. I've had myriad examples from a personal standpoint, but also physician surveys nationwide. I think there's a robust body of evidence corroborating that this is associated with delays in care.
So the AMA has also reported that 90% of physicians experience care delays due to prior authorization, with nearly one-third waiting 3 or more business days for a decision. In your experience, are these wait times typical?
I think a couple business days is expected for that initial process.
Okay.
The longer delays come in as you have to escalate through that appeals process. Yeah. So a first initial prior auth will be accepted or rejected relatively quickly in my experience. But then after that, if I disagree with the rejection, which, you know, I almost always do because that's why I solicited in the first place.
Yeah.
Then you need to schedule a peer-to-peer, which is obviously difficult to fit into a full workday. And that takes time to schedule. And then I've fortunately had an increasing frequency of events where on a peer-to-peer, they may agree with the intervention, but still feel limited from the insurer standpoint that they're unable to approve the medication. And that forces you to then escalate through to an appeals process, which can take up to a month. And so the process can be as short as a day or two to get approval. But if things are denied, there's increasing time delays and as you go through the escalating tiers of the appeals process.
Okay. And so during these delays that you're talking about, do patients generally have access to alternative medications or treatments, or are they often left without options?
So we're pursuing the prior auth for a medication because that's what we believe is best for the patient. So if there is a prolonged delay, yes, we will replace with an alternative medication. But if we thought it was just as effective or just as easy and tolerable for the patient, we would have gone with that to begin with.
Okay.
So yes, there are alternatives that could use in the interim. A classic one, though approvals are easier to obtain now, is biologic therapies for asthma. So they could have their inhaled regimen, they could be on systemic glucocorticoids while awaiting biologic therapy. But the reason you're starting it is because you believe it is better, safer, more effective.
So now in the inpatient setting, if a patient is waiting on authorization for discharge medications or follow-up care, do you think that that keeps them in the hospital longer than medically necessary?
Oh, certainly. Especially also for things like non-invasive ventilation at home. There are things that take time to work through with insurance companies that are not safe to discharge the patient without or yep. not part of our optimal discharge plan to have them go without. And so, yes, that requires more time working with case management inpatient. I will say I have less difficulty navigating the inpatient space because it's more enriched in case manager support and other people on the team that can sort of help. And the lines of communication are more facile from the inpatient world. From the outpatient setting, you know, we have a wonderful pharmacy team here that is incredibly helpful and supportive. Just a shout out to Andrea for being an absolute asset for our team. But it's just not as enriched of a support space in the clinic environment as it is in the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely shout out to our pharmacy team and our case managers who assist in all this for us. Patients that are stuck here in the hospital waiting for these medications, what are the consequences of the delay in terms of cost and outcomes for the hospital?
That's a good question that I don't have the answer to. I would expect that these delays are associated with increased, you know, It's expensive to keep someone in the hospital, $1,000 per day. So I would expect that the aggregate costs are higher, but I don't know that personally.
Okay.
I think one difficulty to add, which is I think very understandable for patients, but as our healthcare system sort of shakes and stumbles and grumbles, there are many things that are laid upon the physician in front of them. And so anger at a system that is struggling, which is like justifiable from the patient, it's not at the Senate or Congress or the president. Things are often laid at the physician in front of them. But I wish the public knew that oftentimes their physician is advocating laboring the best they can, but lack the power to change a system that creates such barriers and impediments to care.
A 2018 Journal of the American Medical Association commentary cited a survey of 1,000 physicians where 92% reported that prior authorization negatively affects patient outcomes, and 61% said that the impact is significant. Does this reflect your experience in practice?
Yes, I entirely agree. I'm reminded of a patient, details adjusted for anonymization and such,
yeah,
but who suffered from EGPA and was on near maximal therapy and required an additional agent, mepolizumab, which is well evidence supported. And it took escalating complaints and appeals to be able to obtain the medication. And during that interval, continued to suffer airway exacerbations. Mm-hmm. And so yes, I undoubtedly the process has led to adverse outcomes.
Yeah. And so I kind of want to move into our populations with dealing with equity and vulnerability. And so you practice as an attending pulmonologist at a level one trauma center and the largest safety net hospital in New England. So many of your patients likely have limited or no insurance coverage. And how does the prior authorization process affect this particularly vulnerable population?
Great question. There's a few things I say. First, I am grateful to practice in a safety net hospital with such a wonderful team of nurses like yourself and a wonderful team here. And I believe we provide excellent care to a community that's deeply in need. Yep. So first, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, we appreciate that.
Second, I will say that I am lucky and fortunate and proud to practice in Massachusetts, which I think is a role model for the rest of the country and how to expand insurance coverage for those most in need. And so I would say that my experience is likely very different in Massachusetts, where MassHealth can be acquired for most of our patients, compared with other parts of the country where that Medicaid expansion or broader insurance coverage would be not as expected. So I think I have a much easier time of it here in Massachusetts than in other states. But even then, yes, caring for patients that have more limited insurance options, that have more limited resources, is certainly a complicating factor in trying to get them the right care, the care they deserve.
Yeah. And so we had talked a little bit about the review process of these medications being approved. And so it often involves this peer-to-peer review process, which is a medical necessity of treatments. But however, there's been criticism regarding the qualifications of those reviewing these cases. Do you believe these reviews should always be conducted by specialists in the same field as the prescribing provider?
I think yes. And I would say if it's provided by someone that doesn't have in-depth knowledge of the diagnosis that we're treating or the medication that we're trying to obtain approval for, and there's a disagreement, then I think there should be deference to the subspecialty expertise that we have and the reason we're soliciting the medication. Mm-hmm. And so I think if there is disagreement, then there should be an easy and ready escalation to someone that shares a similar level of expertise, a similar level of subject matter experience, to actually have a true peer-to-peer discussion. Yeah. So I suppose it would be difficult for me to say that I would want a pulmonologist to review all of my pulmonology requests. But if the internal medicine generalist or family medicine specialist or emergency medicine or whoever it is applying doesn't agree, then I think there should be an easy transition to someone that has treated the condition that I'm trying to escalate care for. And I don't think that should be as difficult to obtain as it is.
Yeah.
So I would say I think I'm okay if the first screen, first pass, is someone with more general, broad experience.
Yep.
But if there's any disagreement, then I think in deference to the fact that medicine is so incredibly complex and no one of us can expect to have in-depth knowledge of every aspect of it, then I think there should be an easier way to connect to someone that truly cares for similar patients, uses similar medications, and can discuss the case with the level of care and nuance that it requires.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of aspects of healthcare, even just within nursing. You know, you have the medical ICU, the surgical ICU, the cardiac ICU, neurology ICU. So there's so many different specialties, and one nurse in one ICU is not going to be able to work in another ICU without proper training and experience. So I would assume that they would have to do that as well for prior authorization process, having a pediatric specialist, you know, approving oncology meds, they're completely different. And so you would need someone with that experience to the experience and knowledge to be answering and approving these medications. So insurance companies also frequently contract third-party organizations to conduct reviews. While this may be cost-effective, there are concerns about a lack of attention due to clinical nuance. Do you believe these organizations should be held to specific standards regarding reviewer expertise?
Yes, I think right now it's too much of a black box, both for the physician, for the public, for the healthcare system writ large. I think it is obfuscated, and I think it is difficult to hold them accountable so that we can continue to provide the level of care we believe our patients deserve. There's a lawsuit that I am reminded of a patient who had pain that was felt to be atypical by the treating orthopedist and wanted an MRI, and the MRI was declined and denied and deferred, and would eventually obtain identified sarcoma. Advanced stage that required more aggressive attempts at treatment than perhaps could have been pursued if it was diagnosed earlier. But I believe that case was dismissed because the reviewing party was not felt to have a medical obligation to the patient. And I think that that shift in responsibility and accountability allows this process to go too unchecked. And I think we as the public, we as voters, we as a political body need to understand that that shift of accountability is something I believe we should address.
Yeah. So I think that sounds very frustrating. And I think that kind of leads us into this topic of like reform efforts and legislation. So recently the insurance provider Humana announced plans to eliminate nearly one third of its prior authorizations, specifically for imaging procedures like MRIs, colonoscopies, and CT scans. Do you see this as a positive step towards reducing unnecessary bureaucracy?
Yes, I am in incredible favor of reducing and streamlining the prior appeals process. And to the degree that they're going to reduce that, I would applaud them for it. I think this is a delay in care that is burdensome, increasingly burdensome over time and getting worse by the year. So yes, I am hopeful to see that individual plans will reduce its use. But that doesn't, to me, get away from the fact that I think it's something we as a voting entity, we as a political body, we in government should do to sort of enact legislation or regulations to set the rules of the marketplace here. Yeah. One example of that I think we could potentially offer is right now the process is Byzantine and different for each individual insurance plan. And there's this form and that form. And I had one appeal denied because I didn't submit a form that was never requested. And it's just incredibly impossible to navigate. And most of it is required to be sent via fax. It feels intentionally difficult at times. And perhaps one way that we can make things better is, yes, hopefully to reduce reliance upon the prior authorization process, but also to create rules and standardization of the appeals process to make it easier to navigate. For example, if it was all electronic and there were standardized forms or standardized documentation so that the process was easier to navigate, because right now it's just incredibly burdensome.
Yeah. I know several states like California, Arizona, Texas, and Connecticut have proposed legislation aimed at reforming prior authorization. So these bills include measures such as requiring specialists to review all the denials, prohibiting AI as the sole basis for denial, imposing shorter decision deadlines, and exempting frequently approved services from authorization. So are you in agreement that these kind of state-level legislations can meaningfully improve the prior authorization process?
Yes, and I think it's a process that's gone too unchecked without boundaries being set.
So here in Massachusetts, pending legislation seeks to reduce unnecessary requests, like for generic medications, extend the duration of approvals once granted, and ensure greater transparency in the approval and the appeals process. Do you think these changes would lead to better outcomes and more efficient care for our patients?
Resoundingly, yes.
We talked a little bit about AI and the automation in the prior authorization process. So artificial intelligence has increasingly been integrated into the prior authorization process, leading to lawsuits and legislation around its use. Are you aware of how AI is being used in this space, and do you believe it could be a helpful tool if used appropriately?
I'm skeptical of anything used to deny coverage that is unable, when asked, to expand upon why.
Yeah.
So I am not an expert in AI or in how it's being utilized here, but the degree to which it would result in an adverse recommendation. No, we are not going to cover this, but there's no person to ask why or describe why, and it's purely an outcome. That, to me, seems dangerous, and I would not be in favor of. But I'll fully admit to a lack of knowledge of how AI is being utilized.
So one lawsuit, Cigna reported, used AI to deny over 300,000 claims in just a few months, and some decisions made in as little as 1.2 seconds. Regardless of how advanced AI becomes, do you believe that's a sufficient amount of time to approve or deny any medical request? I mean, you're talking about someone trying to get meds and we're here in 1.2 seconds saying nope.
Right. That does seem absurd to me. And so I would say no. But I think my deeper problem with those automated processes is that they're not defendable or accountable and not explainable.
Do you have a specific story you can share with us about the appeal process that you've been through, where it had to involve another peer-to-peer review, and what was your experience with that?
I think my most frustrating peer-to-peers have been ones where the person I'm speaking with says, yes, this makes sense. This seems like an appropriate, clinically indicated intervention, but I still can't approve the medication.
Right.
And it just feels so wrong to me. Yeah. And I think there needs to be more accountability on the denial aim of things. That if there is, no, we are not doing this, there needs to be a better exposition of why and accountability if that decision leads to adverse outcomes.
Yeah, so let's say that this adverse outcome leads to death. Is there a way for providers to report this as a state to the state or federal agency? And should such reporting be a standard practice requirement, as this can be used to collect data and then advocate for change in the future?
I'm grateful never to have had anything proceed to that degree. My understanding is the reporting process or the involvement of the state is if you have a rejected appeal internally, you then proceed with an external appeal for state review. I don't know if there's a mechanism to report that I had a prior auth I requested, it was declined, I had a peer-to-peer, it was declined, and I think the process was too drawn out, unfairly so, for myself and for the patient, but then eventually gets accepted in the internal appeals process. I don't know that I have a way to register that discontent right now. That's probably a deficit in my knowledge base, but I wish there was an easier and more effective way to communicate when things seem so broken that they require more intervention and more regulation to fix.
Yeah. So I think we can both agree that having prior authorizations and the original purpose behind them is important and sometimes necessary, but I think there are better ways to do it. And we kind of discussed a few of those. Are there anything or any other suggestions you have for the prior authorization process that you wish and hope for in the future?
Yes, I'll say again, I find the process incredibly frustrating, incredibly burdensome, and that my motivation is for the patient in front of me. I recognize that we as a society do not have infinite resources, and there likely needs to be some mechanism to try and check spending and healthcare utilization. If prior authorization is going to be the tool that we as a society decide to use to shepherd those resources more tightly, then the process needs to be done better. I don't think it's the optimal way to try and constrain costs and try and control excessive healthcare utilization. But even if we were going to settle on prior authorization as the tool, this process of faxing 18 forms, spending 8 hours on hold, having the patient wait days to weeks to months, it just doesn't fit with me in such a modern healthcare system that this is how we're finding how to pay for it. It just seems like a broken model that requires intervention to fix.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you coming here today to talk with us. And we look forward to having you again to maybe discuss some other things here in the medical ICU.
I would love to discuss some happier topics as well.
I will admit
that prior authorization is one of the banes of my existence as a physician. And I feel so guilty for my patients who we discuss something in clinic. I share that I think this is the right intervention for them. And like, you're my doctor. Why can't you get this for me? Right. We said we were going to start this. And the weeks that it takes to navigate obtaining coverage, I feel their frustration, and I wish I can do more for them. It's I would love to come back and talk about happier topics as well.
Yeah, I think that it's a struggle on both physicians and patient side of things, and I think everyone can kind of relate to this process. And knowing that for patients, we feel you, we hear you. And as healthcare providers, we are looking for change and we are looking to improve in the future to prevent struggles for our patients and get the medications that they need.
Yes, one thing I wish patients did understand is I feel my interaction with healthcare suggests to me that the insurers hold more power than the physicians. Yeah. And I think most patients feel the opposite, that if the physician advocates, they will beat the insurance company. And if they fail and the medication is denied, that the physician just didn't try hard enough. But I think the power balance is actually the opposite. And sadly, I think the insurers hold more power than the bedside clinician. And so I do wish that's one thing patients knew, that is, if we're unable to get something, many times it's not for lack of effort, not for lack of attempt. It's simply that I, as the treating physician, due to decades of forces outside of my control, I'm not able always to obtain for them what I believe is right for them.
Yeah. So let's get this information out there and let our patients know to be looking at your legislation and see if there's ways that you can help improve this process for future patients and for yourselves.
Great.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening to us here with Dr. Carney. We just want to let you know you can email us any questions, comments, or ideas at youmakemesickpod@gmail.com or on our Twitter or X page at makemesickpod. And we look forward to having more people on our show in the future. Tune in to listen.